Case number 17-6095, Randy Haight versus Scott Jordan. Oral argument, 30 minutes per side. Mr. Bailey for the petitioner.
Mr. Bailey, it's my understanding that you and Mr. Hackett are going to split your time. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, and you're going to take 14 minutes. He'll take 12, and you each are reserving 2 minutes to rebuttal, right?
With the court's permission, we'll each take 14 minutes, and each of us will reserve 1 minute for rebuttal.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, John Bailey and Bruce Hackett, on behalf of Randy Haight, we do appreciate the court.
We're losing his. He's coming, cutting in and out on us.
Counsel Bailey, can you hear me okay?
I can. Should I try again?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, John Bailey and Bruce Hackett on behalf of Randy Haight, and we appreciate the court allowing us to divide our argument time. I intend to address the issue of trial counsel's failure to remove for cause juror Gall, and if time permits, trial counsel's failure to conduct a competent mental health evaluation and present compelling mitigating evidence.
Counsel, this is Judge Rogers. If you could identify those issues by number, it'd be easier for me to get to my notes.
In the briefing, it's issue one and issue three.
Thank you so much.
And Mr. Hackett intends to address issue nine, ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for failure to raise the trial counsel's refusal to give a required lesser included instruction. And if time permits, issue 10, trial counsel's failure to consult with Randy Haight and request a wanton murder instruction at trial.
Thank you.
With regard to the issue of juror Gall, respectfully, throughout the pendency of this case, up to and including its response brief before this court, and just recently the supplemental authority it filed, the warden has mischaracterized juror Gall's responses in this case. Just within the last week, the warden has argued that juror Gall said that he would not give serious consideration to Randy Haight's primary mitigating evidence. Previously, the warden has argued that juror Gall would be reluctant to consider it, or that it he didn't think much of the mitigating evidence in question. That is not what juror Gall said. Both in response to questions from defense counsel and the trial prosecutor, juror Gall flatly stated that he would not consider Randy Haight's primary mitigating evidence. And by the way, the warden has raised an issue that trial counsel for the defense asked improper questions on voir dire. One, that's not correct. They were perfectly proper questions. And much more importantly, the most damning answer given by juror Gall was in response to the trial prosecutor's question. The trial prosecutor in this case, when questioning juror Gall, did what any experienced capital trial attorney can easily understand in trying to advocate on behalf of the Commonwealth and asking a question that she felt sure she knew the answer would be from juror Gall. And she first tried to give juror Gall one more chance to say that he would consider Randy Haight's mitigating evidence when juror Gall said, no, I will not consider that evidence. The trial prosecutor said, well, you would listen to it at least. And juror Gall said, no, I will not listen to that mitigating evidence. That's what
what we're talking about here is one particular part of the mitigating evidence, not a refusal to hear all, to listen to and consider all the mitigating evidence, correct?
Well, the evidence in question is what Randy Haight's trial counsel termed the main thrust of Randy Haight's mitigation case. So
Well, it was his family background, but he was asked about other things, correct?
There was some other
mitigation. When you label it mitigation evidence, that's just a tiny bit of an overstatement, correct?
I'm sorry?
I said it's a tiny bit of an overstatement to say it's all the mitigation evidence.
No, it was the most important mitigating evidence. I apologize if I said that Juror Gall refused to consider all mitigating evidence. He only refused to consider or even listen to the most important mitigating evidence in Heights case. And in point of fact, that alone disqualifies Juror Gall from sitting in Randy Heights' capital trial. Both this court and the United States Supreme Court have stated unequivocally that a juror may not be precluded from considering and may not refuse to consider mitigating evidence. That's any mitigating evidence. Juror Gall specifically stated that he would refuse to consider, would not even listen to the specific mitigating evidence that Randy Height was basing his case for a life sentence on. So under precedent from both this court and the United States Supreme Court, that makes Juror Gall a biased juror. And this court has stated in at least two cases, we cited Miller versus Webb and Hughes versus United States, that it is ineffective assistance of counsel and prejudice is presumed and a new trial is required when trial counsel allows a biased, unqualified juror to sit on a case. That's exactly what happened in this case. And we know that because the trial prosecutor stated that Juror Gall was unequivocal. That's the word used by the trial prosecutor, unequivocal in their refusal to consider or even listen to Randy Height's primary mitigating evidence. And whatever spin the warden puts on that now, it was the trial prosecutor who was there, who listened to Juror Gall, observed.
I would like to move from that argument into a discussion about that mitigating evidence itself. I have some concerns about the importance of this 1974 report regarding mental incapacity or organic brain damage that was not discovered, despite effort, by trial counsel until the middle of the trial itself. Can you explain the importance of that document in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. The only thing that I would say about Your Honor's question is I'm not sure that it can be fairly characterized that trial counsel did make an effort to uncover this particular type of mental health evidence. Mm-hmm. Talking about organic brain damage, that's what the 1974 report indicated. The only expert that trial counsel retained in this case was a clinical psychologist. It is really beyond any reasonable dispute that a clinical psychologist is not qualified by training or expertise to diagnose organic brain damage. That's a matter of medical literature. And there's no mistaking that fact. So the only expert retained by trial counsel could not have, because he wasn't qualified to, determine that Randy Height had organic brain damage. By comparison, the 1974 report, which Your Honor referenced, was by three mental health experts, including a psychiatrist, who is specifically qualified by training and expertise to uncover organic brain damage.
Here's what I'm struggling with. The counsel finally gets this report in the middle of trial, and it provides, it is a report that was actually ordered by another judge to be undertaken. And yet what we have is a question of whether it was ineffective because counsel didn't find other experts, or you also argue for trial error. But in both of those circumstances, I'm a little bit concerned that funding was never made available for counsel to find other experts on organic brain damage. By my look at the record, it was after trial, straight on through. He was denied funds before trial because of the pending claim about the specific agreement that he had entered. And then after trial, he was denied funds, period. When did Mr. Haight have an opportunity to develop that claim?
Never. Your Honor is 100% correct. Both pre-trial and after trial in the trial court, in the post-conviction court, as Your Honor indicated, up to and including the federal habeas corpus court, Mr. Haight has attempted to obtain the funding to get experts who would be qualified to determine what every doctor who has looked at Mr. Haight's records presumes is the case, that he has organic brain damage. And as I'm sure Your Honor knows, that is a significant piece of mitigating evidence. It's been termed by the United States Supreme Court to be super mitigation. This court has held that it is the type of mitigation that can impact a juror's determination of whether a life sentence or the death penalty is the appropriate punishment in a case.
How can it be ineffective assistance if counsel sought funding and was denied?
Counsel did not do a complete mental health workup, which is the standard of care in a capital case. It's a matter of the ABA guidelines, which have been adopted by the United States Supreme Court.
So is the standard, the requirement that he reach into his own pocket to fund the experts if the court denies it?
That's what we did and habeas, Your Honor. But what I'm saying is the trial counsel never asked for the court to appoint the right type of expert who could diagnose organic brain damage until the trial court said it was too late. Now, as Judge Strange says, we take issue with the trial court's determination that it was too late. But if the trial court was right about that it was too late, it was ineffective assistance of counsel not to have asked for it before. That's what any competent capital defense attorney has to do, a complete mental health evaluation. And that's not just a clinical psychologist who is not qualified to determine a wide range of mental health issues, but certainly organic brain damage, which is what is issued specifically here.
I'm struggling with the denial of the 18 U.S.C. 3599F funding by the court. It seems to me that the standard is whether services are reasonably necessary for the representation of the defendant, including as to the sentence. And yet what we have is continual refusal by the trial court, it's your claim 31, to award any fees for requested experts regarding brain damage as mitigation.
Exactly right. The trial court, the post-conviction court, and the federal habeas corpus district court. And we provided, as Judge Gibbons alluded to, we provided declarations from three highly qualified experts, looked at an enormous amount of records in Randy Haight's case, and had no doubt that further testing would confirm what they could tell from the reports that they did review, and that's that Randy Haight suffers from organic brain damage. And yes, Judge Strange, that is exactly correct. That has never put before any court, much less the jurors who considered what sentence to impose on Randy Haight at trial in this case.
So what's the appropriate remedy if that's the case? Is it a remand to the habeas, to the federal district court?
The determination is that the federal habeas corpus district court should have provided the expert funding requested, then yes.
Well, I have another question for you, and you may not have thought about this or know the answer. I certainly don't. But has there been any change or evolution of our understanding about the effect that of brain damage on behavior since 1980, whenever the trial was? The offense was in 85. I'm not sure when the trial was.
94.
I see that I'm out of time, but with the court's permission, I'll be happy to answer.
You can answer that question.
The answer is yes, Your Honor. There have been new studies, new determination, and new information that has come to light as recently as the past decade about the effects of organic brain damage. There are, as I'm sure Your Honor is familiar with, the DSMs that there have been quite a few of through certainly my legal career. And yes, that is.
Well, how do changes in the state of knowledge affect how we view counsel's decision making? I mean, we can't judge him by today's standards, can we?
But organic brain damage was very well understood in the 1980s to be significant mitigation.
Well, that was what I was asking you.
I apologize. I thought you were asking about the medical rather than the legal, so I misunderstood. I apologize for that. The medical definitions, yes, have evolved and gotten even stronger. The legal definitions were well understood. In fact, we cited to an affidavit that Mr. Height's trial counsel provided in another capital case talking about the significance of organic brain damage. He knew it at the time.
Okay.
And trial counsel knew it at the time. And certainly Mr. Height's trial counsel knew it at the time as he testified in another case. We've presented that to the court.
Okay. Thank you.
The court for its indulgence in allowing me to answer, and I apologize.
Judge Strange, could I ask a short clarifying question that wouldn't take away from his time?
Judge Gibbons, yes.
I'm sorry, Judge Gibbons. Would that be all right?
Sure.
We've moved now from issue one to which subsequent issue? Pardon my pedantic requirement that I get oriented. Is this now issue four?
We've discussed issue three.
Issue three, but issue three, I thought was ineffective assistance of counsel. But
issue three is ineffective assistance of counsel.
This is not an ineffective assistance of counsel argument that you've most recently been discussing. Is that correct?
We've also talked about trial counsel's failure to appoint a qualified expert and the federal district habeas corpus court's failure to.
Those were also three.
Four and five.
Yeah, I thought the trial court's error was claim 31.
All right. And my other question is that subject to AEDPA deference or not?
Well, yes, but.
Okay, that's all I ask.
But may I discuss the
why? Well, if you want to take some of your time, I just want to know which characterization we were dealing with.
This is an important case. I would like to hear the response, if I might, Judge Gibbons, to the Cullen versus Penholster AEDPA rule, particularly in light of that court's ruling that if there's not been an adjudication on the merits, then AEDPA doesn't apply. Can you?
Yes, you can answer that.
I'll do it very quickly, Judge Gibbons. The Kentucky Supreme Court stated the clinical forensic psychologist who examined Randy Height in preparation for trial specifically found no evidence that Height was psychotic or suffered from any serious neurological deficit or was otherwise retarded. They further stated appellant had full benefit of mental health evaluations and experts, and there was no abuse of discretion in trial court's failure to order another such examination. That is 28 U.S.C. 2254 D2 error. That's an unreasonable application of the facts. Courts are required to engage in the facts and apply clearly established federal law. The Kentucky Supreme Court opinion did not do that. It's absolutely incorrect. It's incorrect as a matter of fact and a matter of law to say that Randy Height had the full benefit of a mental health evaluation when he had one psychologist who was not qualified, trained, did not have the expertise to diagnose organic brain damage, which is a significant mitigating factor that every qualified doctor who looked at Randy Height has determined that he suffers from. So that is not a decision by the Kentucky Supreme Court.
Thank you.
Required or should be given. And thank you for your indulgence. I appreciate it.
All right, Mr. Hackett.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mr. Krygo. I would like to address argument 9 in our brief. It was claim 43 in the district court, and it's contained in our brief at pages 184 to 213. The issue is the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for failing to raise on direct appeal a winning issue, the issue being that Mr. Height should have had a theft instruction, a theft jury instruction, as a lesser to the robberies. And of course, the robberies were one of two aggravating circumstances that made him eligible for the death penalty. The ineffective assistance of appellate counsel issue was not raised in Mr. Height's initial post-conviction motion. And the district court found that the claim was procedurally defaulted. The warden also argues that it's defaulted. Mr. Height, when he filed his petition in district court, identified for the court two issues that had not been exhausted. This was one of them. And Mr. Height advised the court in his petition in paragraph 13 of his original petition that Kentucky would not provide a forum for him to litigate his ineffective assistance of appellate counsel issue. Shortly after filing his petition, he filed a motion to stay and obey his habeas petition and go back to state court to exhaust two claims of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. Those issues were pending in Jefferson Circuit Court at the time he filed his petition. Over the warden's objection, he was permitted to do that. He went back to state court and through the Kentucky Supreme Court. The Kentucky Supreme Court agreed with the Jefferson Circuit Court that the courts had no jurisdiction to hear those pending claims.
Mr. Hackett, I'd like to fast forward a little bit on this issue. At the end of the day, tell us what your position is. I mean, a lesser included offense would only have to be charged if the jury could reasonably have found that lesser included offense based on the evidence presented. That may be paraphrasing a little bit, but tell us how you think at the end of the day, Mr. Height could have been successful in obtaining that charge.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Our position is that that particular issue on appeal, on direct appeal, was a winning issue. I think the best evidence of that is the Raymond McClellan case. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm not really interested in cases. I want you to talk about the evidence and how, based on the evidence here, the jury might reasonably have found this lesser included offense.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Height testified. He was asked whether he intended to rob these two victims, and he said no, he did not. Based on his testimony, he was entitled to the lesser offense, and here's why. The offense of robbery requires that the physical force, in this case, the deadly physical force, be used with the intent to commit the theft. His testimony was that he did not have that intent to commit the theft. I referred to the McClellan case because McClellan was another capital case, and his aggravator was first degree burglary. Much like first degree robbery, there are three elements that raise a robbery to first degree and a burglary to first degree. It's the possession of a deadly weapon, the use of a dangerous instrument, or the use of physical force against the victim. In Mr. McClellan's case, Mr. McClellan was trying to persuade his wife to come back to him. She had left and gone to live with a former husband. Mr. McClellan bought a gun 2 days before the killing. He rented an apartment in the same building as his wife and her ex-husband. He waited there until they returned at night. He went to the door and knocked on the door. The victim answered, Mr. Stutzenberger answered, slammed the door. Mr. McClellan shot the lock off the door, went into the apartment. The important issue there was that he entered or remained in the dwelling with the intent to commit a crime. Mr. McClellan testified, I did not intend to commit a crime inside. All I wanted to do was talk to my wife. We think that the testimony of Mr. McClellan in his case was reversed and he got a new trial based on that testimony because he should have had a trespass instruction based on his testimony. So Your Honor, it is the testimony of Randy Height, which entitles him to the lesser instruction. Now the magistrate judge initially when making recommendations on I believe the motion for discovery or the motion for an evidentiary hearing or both made the mistake of saying, well, Judge Shobe, the trial judge, judged the credibility of Mr. Height and found that he wasn't entitled to the instruction. Well, that is not permitted at all. A judge cannot judge credibility. A judge obviously could not say, well, you said you were acting in self-defense, but I'm not going to give a self-defense instruction because I don't find your testimony credible. It just can't be done. If Mr. The warden seems to be making the same sort of argument in this appeal when he refers to Mr. Height's testimony and says it's meaningless and rang hollow on page 81 of his brief. And as I said, that is just simply wrong to say that a judge, when it comes to instruction time, could judge a person's credibility and say, no, you may not have that instruction. As far as the procedural default of this claim, what Mr. Height is asking for is the same treatment that Mr. Boykin, Mr. Matthews, Mr. Halverson, and Mr. Pellini got in their cases in this court. Each one of them did not raise the issue of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel in the state court, and each one of them was allowed to present the claim to this court and get a merits ruling on the underlying issue. And that's what Mr. Height is also asking. under, of course, the reason why he, there was a problem in state court with Mr. Height presenting the issue is that there the case of Lewis versus Commonwealth said that ineffective assistance of appellate counsel was not a cognizable issue in Kentucky. That case came after a case by the name of Hicks versus Commonwealth, where the Supreme Court of Kentucky said that a litigant could, if they lost their appeal completely, if their appeal was dismissed, if the appellate court never got to the merits of the appeal, then that person could get relief in the appellate court, could get a belated appeal. But a person whose case was briefed and got a ruling on the merits of the issues could not present a claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel to the Kentucky courts anywhere. All courts lack jurisdiction until they changed their mind in 2010 with the case of Holland versus Commonwealth. When the Kentucky Supreme Court decided Holland, one of the things that they said is, we are going to permit that ineffective assistance of appellate counsel issues, we're going to allow them to be raised. They set out the procedure by which they could be raised. They amended Kentucky's post-conviction criminal rule to accommodate the newly recognized claim. But then they said, we don't have to apply this decision retroactively. And one of the reasons why they said it didn't have to apply retroactively was that, and I quote from the case that, quote, the federal courts have provided a forum through habeas review, see Boykin versus Webb. Kentucky defendants have not therefore been denied an opportunity to vindicate their right to effective appellate counsel, and there is thus no need for our decision today to reach back and operate retroactively, end quote. So we are asking this court to allow Mr. Height to present the merits of his claim to the court and to get a merits ruling. And if the court has no questions, I believe that's all I have at this time.
Are there further questions? All right, Mr. Kriegel? Tell us how to pronounce it.
Kriegel. Thank you. Okay. May it please the court. My name is Matthew Kriegel. I'm from the Kentucky Attorney General's office, and I represent the warden in this matter. May it please the court, Mr. Hackett, Mr. Bailey. Just 2 months shy of 36 years ago, on August 22nd, 1985, Randy Height killed two people in cold blood. Patricia Vance, a 33-year-old mother of two, and David Omer, a 40-year-old father of three, were gunned down in a most vulnerable state when they presented absolutely no threat to Mr. Height. Horrible, senseless, tragic were the words used by defense counsel when this trial opened, as it was made crystal clear that this case was not a whodunit. Height, who between the ages of 18 and 41 had managed to spend approximately 2 years outside a prison cell, admitting to killing two innocent people. It's against this backdrop that I appear before you today. I'll address the issues in the same order that they were addressed by my opponents and start with ineffective assistance of counsel as it relates to juror Leroy Golf, the failure to strike him for cause.
Before we go through that, I would like you to address the issue of this 1974 report. Your opening got it exactly right. It said, this is a man who has spent all of his life up to this crime effectively in prison, and a man who a state court judge, an Ohio state court judge, said when he was 21 years old, I want this man evaluated. and they appointed three experts to evaluate his mental health and potential brain damage. Why isn't that just a key document here? You say Haight failed to make even a rudimentary showing that further evaluation was necessary. How can that 1974 report be more than a rudimentary showing that he needed an expert?
Your Honor, it's because the report only noted the possibility of brain damage. And when analyzing the issue as it's framed before us today, specifically ineffective assistance of counsel with respect to his investigation and preparation for mitigation, you would look at what he did to uncover that report. And it's apparent from the beginning that there were a lot of issues that defense counsel had no control over. In particular, that report was 21 years old by the time it was provided. And it was found on microfiche by one of the investigators mid-trial. And again, it only dealt with the possibility of brain damage, which was directly contradicted by the expert that was appointed for Mr. Haight, Dr. Fisher. And Dr. Fisher was a Harvard-educated forensic psychologist with expertise in criminal cases. He was a Duke professor.
Your opposing counsel says that a forensic psychologist is not what was needed in this case. It was a neurologist.
Well, he's saying that I apologize, I didn't mean to interrupt. He's saying that the forensic psychologist couldn't properly diagnose it, but he could certainly have determined the need for additional testing. And he did note that in his report. He said there are no signs of neurological deficits, no signs of intellectual disability, no signs of psychosis. And that was consistent with the other reports that were available from Dr. Gussett, who was an evaluation on Mr. Haight when he was 14 years old. So again, we're looking at it through the lens of AEDPA deference in the context of what sort of investigation defense counsel did and what could he have done differently. And getting this report mid-trial, he immediately moved to get an additional expert, and that motion was denied.
But that's the other side of this argument. If we set aside for a moment the ineffective assistance of counsel argument and look instead at the claim of court error for failing to authorize funding to do this examination, then you fit, don't you, within Aki, which in 2017, the Supreme Court in McWilliams versus Dunn said Aki is clearly established law for AEDPA purposes. And it holds that indigent persons presenting credible evidence of brain damage are entitled to state funds for further investigation. Why doesn't a report from 1994 by three experts that was ordered by a court to be undertaken that says that there are underlying schizophrenia, there is cortical dysfunction, there is underlying psychosis, delusions, borderline retardation, and the likelihood of drug dependency. Why isn't that sufficient to show, particularly in light of the other analyses that said that this young man's IQ declined while he was a young man, which is further evidence of organic brain damage? Why isn't that sufficient to fit within Aki and require the court to authorize funding for an expert?
Because the court had already authorized funding and provided Mr. Haight with an expert that directly contradicted that report. And in particular, that report only referred to the possibility of brain damage. It didn't establish even a probability of brain damage. It spoke only to a possibility. And so there wasn't any concern with a violation of the requirements of AEDPA such that the trial court had failed to consider mitigation evidence. And then you have to look at this case again from the standpoint of a global perspective. And in this particular instance, that it would have been impossible to show lack of prejudice here, or to prove prejudice.
I think the question here, you're going to have to explain to me why there is the prejudice argument that you're raising, when what we are talking about is a violation of 18 U.S.C. 3599F, a request for for indigent habeas petitioners, where it is reasonably necessary for representation of the defendant related to his sentencing included, that he authorize these services. And my look at this case is that counsel asked over and over and over for funds for this type of expert. Beginning in 85, he was blanketly denied the funds because there was the other pending settlement issue. Then at trial, after trial, he requested when he got this report, and he was denied by the trial court, he was denied by post-conviction, and he was denied by the habeas court. When did he ever have an opportunity to receive funding for the experts that were requested regarding organic brain damage?
He was allowed to do that when the Height versus Williamson, Height 2 case was completed. And unfortunately, the expert that was originally going to examine him, for whatever reason, declined. And so counsel had to find a new expert.
I'm struggling with that answer because that was before he had the 1974 report. And that is where he had three experts. The question being, wasn't that reasonable evidence and information that should have justified the appointment? From the date he received that, I think it was January 22nd of 1994, when did he ever have funding to hire a neurological or brain damage expert? I can't find anywhere in the record that he did.
He had already received that funding, which was how Dr. Fisher was hired. If we're talking about 3599, my position is that Cullen versus Penholster prevents it because the claim was adjudicated on the merits and you don't take new evidence at this point when that's occurred. But if we're talking about at the actual trial, when the 1973 report was finally unearthed, again, the possibility of brain damage, which was directly contradicted by the expert that had already been appointed, when that came about, that didn't necessitate the need for an additional appointment of an expert. And again, you're still going to have to look at this through the lens of what sort of is there any prejudice here? You've got a defendant who has literally been a career criminal. By the time the sentencing phase began, he had been convicted of 24 felonies. He had committed crimes from the moment he escaped from the Johnson County Jail, burglaries, robberies, an attempted murder on a Kentucky State police officer. Of course, the underlying facts of this case, he approached a car with two guns, one in each hand, cocked and loaded. He murdered two innocent people at point blank range in cold blood while they were in the back of a station wagon sharing an intimate moment on a country road.
But counsel, this is Judge Rogers. How does that go to the question of whether he should have been granted funds to show organic brain damage? I'm not sure what organic, how, what
it, it,
brain
it goes
damage
to,
is not, what inorganic versus organic brain damage is, but apart from that, presumably, if you have the organic type, it's going to be more sympathetic to the jury than if you have the inorganic type. Is that the idea?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, but it goes to the issue that my opponents were attempting to raise, at least within the framework of claim number three, whether or not there was ineffective assistance of counsel related to the presentation of mitigation.
I understand that, but I perceive Judge Strange to be raising some difficult issues that don't deal with ineffective assistance of counsel, but rather deal with error on the part of the error that either isn't subject to AEDPA or passes the AEDPA standards of the courts in denying or not providing funding that goes to organic brain damage. I don't want to characterize my colleague's inquiry, but if that's the nature of her inquiry, then I'm just curious to know what your response to that is. And when you say, well, this is an egregious crime, that is a response, but I'm not sure it goes exactly or directly to the question of whether, in his defense of that, he might have been gotten some slight modicum of additional sympathy if the jury had known that he had organic brain damage as opposed to inorganic brain damage. Now, you can say, well, that's a mox-nix distinction, and so there's no prejudice. Or you can say, even if there is such a distinction, there was no need. That's what I took to be your earlier argument, is that there hadn't been enough indication that there was organic brain damage at that point in time. And you went through, basically, it's when you backed up to the we need to look at the big picture and this is a terrible crime. That was the logical move that I found difficult to track. Are you with me?
I am, and I apologize. Issues 3, 4, and 5 are sort of bleeding together right now. And so there's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. There's a trial court error related to not adding an additional expert at sentencing. And then there's a claim related to not getting funding from the district court. And
I think now we're concerned about 4 and 5.
Right. And I understand that. And so my response to that would be that when you look at what the trial court had before him in terms of the having sat through the trial and heard Dr. Fisher's testimony, and then this report is received that just notes a possibility of brain damage that seems to be contradictory to everything else that the trial court had heard, and it happens to be extremely remote in time, and you take all of that into account, I don't think there's an unreasonable application of federal law by the judge deciding not to grant an additional expert at that sentencing phase.
And that was, at what point is the decision being made that you just referred to?
Pardon me, I'm sorry.
At what point in the proceedings, at what point in the progression of proceedings was that decision made when the one
during the sentencing phase?
During the sentencing phase.
Or no, I'm sorry, not sentencing, but sentencing hearing. The sentencing phase had already happened. It was during the sentencing hearing that Mr. Lewis, defense counsel, requested the additional.
Well, the jury had already recommended the death penalty, but the trial court had not yet imposed it. Is that
correct?
Right? And it was at the hearing to consider whether the trial court was going to do that or not. That's where the motion was made, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And at that point, did they have this report from many years before that Judge Strange has been referring to?
Yes.
That's when they received it. The
report was received mid-trial. Mr. Lewis doesn't specify an exact time period that I'm aware of.
It was before that point that we're talking about.
Right, but he basically, I think at the motion for a new trial hearing, which was sort of coupled with the sentencing hearing, he noted that I received it mid-trial. It was too late for me to do anything with it. I was in the middle of a capital trial.
I see.
And so that's kind of the...
I'm just trying to get oriented.
Sure. I understand.
Can I ask you a question about the proper big picture here? when we talked about the big picture, you went to the facts of the case, but isn't there a smaller big picture that is pertinent for resolution of these, of this question with respect to trial court error? The big picture to look at, to consider that is the amount of mitigation evidence that in fact was presented on behalf of Mr. Height, which would be Dr. Fisher, it would be the social worker's testimony, all of the information about his upbringing, his past, his difficulties. And then finally, the other part of the big picture, it seems to me, is that we're not reviewing the trial judge's decision here for abuse of discretion as we would in if we were directly reviewing it. I mean, we're a federal court and we're operating under habeas restrictions. So is that not the right relevant big picture for this issue?
Yes, Judge Givens, that is correct. And I would note there was an extensive mitigation case here. The
This was the one day, right?
It was it was more than one day. The Commonwealth only sentencing evidence from the Commonwealth had to do with criminal history. The rest of the first, all of the second, and part I think of the third, Dr. Fisher I believe was on February 3rd. All of that came from, or all of that involved testimony from Height's family members, the social worker in particular in 1994 did a particularly good job. I think she probably today would be referred to more as a mitigation specialist rather than just a social worker who happened to put all this together. But she had interviewed a lot of people and had done an extensive background study into Mr. Height. The jury had a complete, full, accurate picture of him. They had just a wealth of information about his family life and in particular, his difficult upbringing, his mother and father. His mother testified twice, once in the guilt phase and once in the penalty phase. They heard from his sister. They heard from people that he worked for at the jail in correctional industries, making furniture. There was an extensive mitigation case put on for Mr. Height, which included mental health evidence, and in particular that he was suffering from an extreme emotional disturbance.
I understand that was really the gist, that it was an extreme emotional EED claim there. But what I'm struggling with is the time in mitigation that came in, the factors that were raised there seem to me to point to or red flags to what would be an actual organic, a brain damage claim. And yet, because, you know, what did they say? His father beat him with everything he could get a hold of. But what was missing from that and what was not funded was a neurologist, someone with the expertise to explain what that all of that damage meant. And it meant, their argument, as I understanding it, is that the desire was to show that he was brain damaged. I think everything else in there fits within that category, but I don't even see the trial court addressing that. The motion for new trial was February 4. And I'm looking and here, and there was a hearing before the court that was held on March 7. I can't even find an order that addresses these mental health issues or the request for funding. And then subsequent to that, I find nothing. I find motions for money. Give us some money and enable us to have a neurologist speak to his brain damage issues, but it was completely denied. Am I incorrect? Was there some opportunity for an expert to provide information on organic brain damage or to even investigate or meet with or evaluate Mr. Height for those issues up to today?
Yes, the Dr. Fisher, that was his role. And again, that they are asserting that, well, he couldn't diagnose this specific brain damage, which, yeah, he's not going to look at brain scans and that sort of thing, but he can still use the instruments available to him, and he did, and determined that there was no evidence of any neurological issues, no evidence of psychosis, no evidence of mental retardation. He had IQ scores that ranged between somewhere in the mid 80s and the low 70s. And so I understand the point you're trying to make, but I also, I don't think the jury could not have had it would have been very difficult to have a more clear picture of exactly who they were dealing with in this.
Well, I guess my core question is, Fisher is a clinical forensic psychologist, and he testified at trial, correct?
Correct.
Before the 1974 three expert evaluation was even found, right?
So I don't know, because I don't know exactly when, again, because Mr. Lewis says it was received mid-trial, I don't know exactly what day
it was received on January 22nd. And my understanding of the answer of counsel is that he did not raise it at trial because he was in the middle of the trial. As soon as the trial was over, he raised it in a motion for a new trial. And it's from that point on that I never see a response from the court evaluating that need. And we obviously never see any authorization for funds that I think the Supreme Court in Ayestas, Judge Alito talking about the reasonable attorney would regard these investigative services as sufficiently important to demonstrate that they were reasonably necessary, which falls into Aki, which Dunn says is clearly established law for the purposes of AEDPA. I'm just struggling with why wasn't appropriate to authorize that funding.
Well, I would just point out that the Ayestas case that you just referred to is a Martinez versus Ryan, Trevino versus Thaler case. So you're looking at an underlying ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim. And again, here, when you look at that, that's where prejudice comes in. That's where the big picture comes in. That's where you look at the fact that as a defense attorney, you're entitled to rely on the opinions of experts. This expert told him there were no neurological impairments. None of the
psychologist.
Right. And again, I realize he can't diagnose.
Your opposing counsel says a psychologist simply cannot be an expert on neurological damage.
He said he can't diagnose it. But I don't think that prevents him from using the instruments that are available to him in his area of expertise and determining that further investigation is needed because there is some sort of indicator that shows that there is some sort of brain damage.
In other words, I think that's the
difference. And especially when you're looking at the Ayestas case, also the reason that analysis happened was because the claim wasn't raised and it wasn't adjudicated on the merits. Here we have an issue where we have an ineffective assistance of counsel claim that was adjudicated on the merits, so that case doesn't apply.
Would agree with you. The Martinez angle of that case doesn't. The question is whether the opinion from Aki and Yestas speaks to what is reasonably necessary in accordance with 18 U.S.C. 3599F. And that is the language of that statute. But that statutory authorization for funding was denied.
Right. And again, I would assert that the denial in the district court was based on the principles in Cullen v. Penholster. The denial at the trial court level was based on the fact that he had already been appointed an expert and the 1973 report merely noted a possibility. It did not go far enough that it would have required the judge to hire an additional or allow an additional expert. Before
Mr. Kreigel, I think at this point we should allow you an opportunity to say something about issues 9 and 10 if you want to.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. I would simply note with regard to issue number 9, the theft by unlawful taking, the McClellan case that my opponent refers to talks about burglary, and in the burglary statute, there has to be the intent to commit a crime when you enter a dwelling. In the robbery statute, in the course of committing a theft, which occurred here, the defendant in this case used physical force on another with the intent of accomplishing a theft. And his argument is, well, he didn't intend to commit a theft. But actually, the testimony from Mr. Height, where he says that he didn't mean to do what happened, is referring to killing both of these individuals. He's not talking about a theft there. So there is still sufficient evidence to show that he intended a theft when he walked up to that car, and there isn't evidence that would have supported a theft by unlawful taking instruction. The difference there being in the burglary statute, the intent to commit a crime, not necessarily theft, versus in the robbery statute, the intent has to be to commit a theft. And I don't think his disclaimer that I didn't mean for it to happen with regard to when he was asked about killing these individuals refers to the theft. He's referring to his intent with regard to murder. And with respect to wanton murder, issue number 10, there are a number of issues with the procedural default of both the ineffective assistance of counsel claims. The McGinnis case that I cited in my brief is applicable and prevents any of these underlying claims from being available. So there can't be ineffective assistance of counsel or ineffective assistance of appellate counsel when the underlying law doesn't support the error. And with that, I see my time is almost up.
Judge Gibbons, may I ask a question about one of the other issues? Just one question.
Sure, sure. Yes, sir.
Mr. Kreigel, I have a question about issue 8, which is whether
the instructions,
which I guess you agree were incorrect, whether they were harmless. And the instruction has to do with the lesser included offense of manslaughter. Is that ringing a bell?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you did argue in your brief, if I'm correct, that the error in the instruction or the incorrectness in the instruction was harmless. Is that correct?
It is. And
here's my question, because we just have a little time.
Sure.
It's a little hard for me to see how it's harmless to have that instruction when the defendant has a right to a lesser included instruction under the law. If the defendant has a right to the lesser included instruction on the theory that the jury might find it sufficient to find the lesser included rather than the greater one, that's the whole reason for the right?
Correct.
Nobody likes to be convicted of anything, but they like it if it serves as a substitute for something worse, right? That's the underlying idea. And I'm just having trouble drawing from, or I wonder what your response is to the question as to how can it be, if he has the right to a lesser included instruction in a particular situation, doesn't he lose that right when the elements are wrongly laid out?
No,
that's my question. Do you see my question?
Yeah, my answer would be no. If the elements are laid out in a way that is favorable to the defendant, and here there was a technical error, I would argue that it was a non-prejudicial error because in essence, created a gap between the two statutes and would have allowed an acquittal where otherwise it wouldn't have existed. The easy answer to the harmless error analysis would look at just the fact that the jury found him guilty under the murder statute, so it found beyond a reasonable doubt absence of EED, so it didn't necessarily matter what was written in the manslaughter.
Well, but I don't know. I mean, it doesn't matter unless you think he has a right to a lesser included instruction. He has a right to a lesser included instruction. It doesn't say that it's harmless because the jury found on the greater included instruction. Because the whole idea is that if he had a lesser one, they might have opted for the lesser one. So they say, well, you could also convict him of this lesser one, but you're going to have to show some weird things. Hypothetically. Then that's the equivalent of not getting the lesser included, which is taking a chance that he won't get the bigger one. Are you with me?
But in this instance, the error alleged was that it impermissibly shifted the burden to Mr. Height when it in fact did not. If you look at the case, the Sandstrom case or the Mullaney case, both of those deal with a situation where it's obvious that a defendant was required to do more than they should have been required to do. In this instance, that wasn't the case. So as even though there was a technical error, it was a non-prejudicial error that actually was to Mr. Height's benefit and didn't harm him.
Well, how exactly was it to his benefit? Oh, that's what I'm having trouble seeing.
Because it created a greater burden of proof for the Commonwealth under both instructions. And also it is helpful to look at the instructions as a whole, and you'll see that in instruction 9 and the reasonable doubt instruction as well, that the burden of proof was always correctly laid at the feet of the Commonwealth. There was never any instance where Mr. Height was required to prove an element of the offense or had the burden impermissibly shifted to him. And for that reason, it was a harmless error.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Bailey and Mr. Hackett, you will each have your 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The warden makes two arguments that because there were bad facts in this case, no mitigating evidence would have changed the jury's verdict. And because defense counsel presented some mitigating evidence, it doesn't matter that didn't present more important mitigating evidence. Both of those arguments have been roundly and repeatedly rejected by the United States Supreme Court. Numerous cases in our briefs that deal with exactly those two issues. And there are cases where the defense presented more mitigating evidence that the court found that the lack of important mitigating evidence, and there's no more important mitigating evidence than organic brain damage, was prejudicial to the defense. Second, the warden repeatedly says that this is just the possibility of brain damage, not the probability. The 1973 report, the doctors, after doing neuropsychological testing, said that it revealed symptoms of cortical dysfunction and brain damage. Dr. George Woods, a neuropsychiatrist, said there were clear indications of organic brain damage. Dr. Motley, a neuropsychologist, said that there were clear indications of organic brain damage. It's not the possibility, it's the probability. And if I had ever had a chance to present expert testimony to the board, that would have been.
All right. Mr. Hackett.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to make one point about both of the claims 9 and claim 10. Regarding claim 9, the right to the lesser theft instruction to the jury, the Attorney General at a couple of times quoted one of the things that Mr. Height said, and that was, I didn't mean for it to happen. That is not what we're basing this issue on. Mr. Height was asked specifically, did you intend to kill these people? He said, no. Did you intend to rob these people? He said, no. That's what's the equivalent of what occurred in the McClellan case, where Mr. McClellan said that he did not intend to commit a crime in the dwelling. So It's very, he was asked a very specific question and he answered. With regard to with regard to issue 8, the manslaughter instruction, the warden has argued that the erroneous
make this brief because your time is up, but I understand that you're responding to a question that was asked by one of us, so we'll let you finish your answer or your response.
Thank you. I appreciate your honor. The point that I'd like to make is these instructions never place the burden on the Commonwealth to prove anything except in the murder instruction. They had to prove the absence of extreme emotional disturbance. Otherwise, the instructions told the jury, if you believe from the evidence and beyond a reasonable doubt, all of the following. They did not have, they did not place the burden on the Commonwealth for any of the elements, for any of the offenses, except in that one instance where they were told that the Commonwealth had the burden to prove the absence of EED in order to convict of murder. EED was Mr. Height's defense. It was described that way by the Kentucky Supreme Court. Therefore, he's the one that had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was acting under the influence of extreme emotional disturbance. And that is the problem with the instruction.
All right. We appreciate the argument that all of you have given. I note particularly that Mr. Bailey and Mr. Hackett were both appointed to represent Mr. Height under the Criminal Justice Act. You do render an important service to the court as well as your client. We're very, very appreciative of undertaking this representation. It's hard enough to take on a CJA case under any circumstances, but when it's a death penalty case that requires the degree and extent of preparation that those cases do, we're especially appreciative and know how it has an impact on your practice and everything else you do.